danger is stealing in as relapse hums above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day.
Hello and welcome to episode 192 of the Thinking Poker Podcast from Catonsville, Maryland. I'm Andrew Brokus. Nate Mavis is not with me yet, but he will be with me very, very soon. Perhaps even more exciting, Tommy Angelo will be with us, one of our all-time favorite guests, one of your all-time favorite guests. Always a great conversation with Tommy Angelo, and among other things, we'll get his thoughts on not necessarily William Kassouf specifically, but on the whole idea of speech play, trying to tilt your opponents at the table, whether you should get tilted by opponents, what you should or shouldn't do by opponents, about opponents who are trying to tilt you or intentionally or not, taking a long time, calling the clock. We'll talk about all that sort of stuff and a lot more. It's a great interview with Tommy Angelo, as they always are, so stay tuned and be sure to check out Tournament Poker Edge. This is a great time to sign up for Tournament Poker Edge. As many of you know, I make videos for Tournament Poker Edge. My latest video series there covers key hands from my 2016 World Series of Poker main event. And later this month, I'll have a series where I review hands from the World Championship of Online Poker. But the most exciting World Championship of Online Poker news is that Tournament Poker Edge instructor Jace Regina won $109 WCOOP event, and right now on Tournament Poker Edge, you can watch him review hand for hand that win. Find out how in the hell somebody wins a tournament with thousands of players. See how Jace does it. It's a great time to sign up for Tournament Poker Edge, which you can do at www.tournamentpokeredge.com.
Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning. How are
you? Hi, guys.
My last two interviews have been video. And you know what? I like it this way.
Yeah, I don't think people need to see what I look like. I'm actually fully clothed at the moment, but that's not a guarantee for these interviews.
Well, the thing I miss is, it kind of reminds me of the debates. It's like, okay, when you're talking, I want to be over here like making notes, chugging my coffee, whatever. And I'm like, I feel like I'm kind of on camera all the time. It's not as much fun.
You haven't read Infinite Jest, have you, Tommy?
Say that again?
You've not read Infinite Jest, the David Foster Wallace novel?
No, I've heard of that one.
It's
Did you tell me about it?
Quite possibly. Nate and I are both big fans of Wallace in general and that book in particular. But
talk about it. Yes. And I looked into that.
I might have even recounted this anecdote to you before, but one of my favorite passages in there, the book is set in sort of like a near future, and the narrator recounts the history of the video phone, and this was written well before Skype existed, and he kind of says initially it was like a very exciting thing that you could see the people, and then you slowly realized that you didn't really want to know what people were doing while you were talking to them. You like to have the illusion that you had their complete attention, and so people would start, they had these masks that they would wear so that you would sort of see a blank version of their face, or a something they would put over the screen, so you would see a picture of them but not actually see what they were doing. And then over time people would start getting these more vain versions, sort of a more beautiful version of themselves would be displayed on the screen. And then it became kind of like a retro hipster sort of thing to actually show your face or to show a less glamorous version of you, and eventually the video phone just fell from favor entirely.
Right, nobody wanted it. That's really cool. I can see that happening. Well, it is kind of happening, I guess.
Yeah, I think a lot of that kind of stuff has actually happened.
Good to hear your voice again, Nate.
Yeah, it's great to hear you. It's great to talk to you, too. It's been a while.
Yeah. In fact, I meant to look that up. I have it. Oh, I have at my new website. Oh, let's go look at this real quick. Hop on over to TommyAngelo.com.
Okay.
And go over to other stuff on the far right where it says interview archive.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, this is a new website.
Yeah, it's all new. I've been working on this for months. I got a guy.
It's very elegant. It's very elegant. Yeah.
Thank you. So scroll on down. Look at those nice pictures I found of Christy and Joe. And Andrew, yeah, if you want another picture, just send it on over. I just grabbed that offline.
Yeah, I don't know if I have any making a face quite like those two.
But
I don't know if this is the time to give you edits, but there's no E at the end of Christy's last name.
Oh, this is absolutely a time for edits. This thing is raw. There's no E where?
So you have Christy Arnett with an E at the end of Arnett.
Ah, okay. That's so funny because when she sent me her little blurb that she was putting up about this interview, she had misspelled breathe with or breath with an E on the end. and I said, I got to tell you.
She decided she wanted E's at the end of every word.
Yeah. Okay. So Arnett has no E. Okay. Thank you. See, that's why I'm able to just take notes furiously over here with nobody watching. It's nice.
Immediately after saying we did.
You guys are going to have. What's that?
Go ahead, Tommy.
No, I was just going to say, after this interview, after it goes up, I'll put it up here, and you're going to have. You're going to be tied with the 2+2 guys.
For most conversations.
This isn't every interview. This is just the ones we could find. Links to, you know, that still had live links.
Sure. I was looking for the Badoogie All-Stars, but I guess that was a while ago.
Yeah, what happened was we thought about, because I had a number of them downloaded to my server, and we just decided not to mess with that, you know, because this site is really, the whole site now is about the future, about, you know, because I intend to be doing a ton of interviews, ton of new stuff coming up with the book coming out, and so
yeah,
so it doesn't really matter so much who I talked to 5 years ago. What's that?
So you keep your website in the past and future, but your mind in the present?
Yeah, that's it.
Okay. Sure. seems like a good way to distribute time among various, you know, parts of your life.
Well, the idea is that you consciously go into the past and future.
Okay.
And then, you know, then it's okay.
Okay, good. I think my understanding of being present in meditation is still not what it ought to be.
Well, maybe I'll probably get going on that today.
So the book is coming out soon.
So are we podcasting right now?
Oh yeah, we've been recording from the second you answered the phone. Okay. I mean, unless if there's something in there you don't want, that's fine. But I thought it was all interesting.
Okay then. So, what was the question?
I don't. You said you've been revamping the website with kind of because the book was coming soon, or you're kind of looking forward towards promoting the book. Is that getting close?
It is very close. So the release date is March 1st, 2017. Right now, if you hop on over, are you at the site right now?
Yeah.
Okay. So just go to the top where it says books. Scroll down to Painless Poker.
Oh, coming 3/1/17.
Right. And there's a little blurb there that's like the first draft of it, but it's going to be redone. But that blurb right there tells you, it's like a synopsis of the book. And I'm just so psyched. I've been working on it since it's going to be done. The interior of the book will be finished this year. I'm on the very, very last round of edits right now with my editor. And so it's going to end up being 7 years from start to finish.
But it's quite a project.
Yeah, it really has been. I'm really excited with how it came out. And this is the funnest part of tweaking because it's, you know, it's all there. Every little thing now is just, you know, making it a little bit better, a little bit tighter. I keep finding, I call it the catch of the week. I've been saving these because I'll keep finding things that can only be found pretty much by me. Like another, like I'm going to talk a little bit about the work you did, Andrew, but it has to do with subtle things. For example, one guy wears a long sleeve t-shirt, and then there's a scene later where I have him, they talk about his white skin, and I said that he looked at his forearms. Well, he can't see his forearms because he wears a long sleeve shirt. And there's like, I keep finding all these subtle little things because I'll write one thing, let's say in 2014. And the next time I go through that part will be a year later. And another idea will come up about some visual, and I won't be holding the other visual in my mind. And the only way to catch the conflict is like a year after that. And wow. It's so anyway, I just want to tell your listeners that Andrew is what is one of my, has been one of the main, what I'm calling beta readers. My editor, Anna, came up with that term, which I love. So there's been two batches of beta reading on this book. One was about 2 years ago, a year and a half ago, Andrew?
When I was doing it?
Yeah.
No, I think it was less than a year because it was right around Christmas. I think it was about this time last year that we met.
Wow.
And maybe even a little bit later, because I remember feeling a little rushed to try to get it to you by Christmas.
Oh, okay. Well, there we go. So, God, that's so interesting. It's like the first draft took 4 years, and the second draft took like a year and a half, and then it reduces by about 30% every time. And this last time through, it took me 3 weeks. But anyway, at that point, when Andrew read it, it was still pretty rough. And the feedback you gave was just essential at correcting and redirecting some really important things. And also determining, is this book readable by non-poker players? And then just more recently, I had two more people read it. Because after you read it, Andrew, I did a lot of work after that, a major overhaul. That was probably a 9-month revision. And then the last two readers, one of them was a non-poker player, the first non-poker player to read it. And he read the first chapter, which is definitely readable by non-players. And then he was into the part in the Painless Poker Clinic. And the note he wrote was, I'm just so disappointed. This book is not for me. I was like, you know, and I knew that the lingo was just too much. I didn't try to like dummy it down. That's one of the things you and I talked about. You know, that's why I brought it up.
Yeah, whether you should be going broad with it.
Yeah, yeah. Because it really distracts the poker players to have those little dummy down passages. You know, it's like, who's he talking to here? You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm a little bit surprised that would sort of turn off a reader so much. Have you read All the Pretty Horses by Cormac McCarthy?
No.
You know, so it's full of a very technical horse vocabulary that I know nothing about. So like not just mm-hmm. saddles, but parts of saddles and like specific kinds of rope and breeds and all this. And I think the average reader is not expected to know it. And second, there's a bunch of Spanish in it and I don't speak Spanish. And I think that's just kind of, I mean, it makes it sort of immersive in a strange way. And I'm a little bit surprised that readers would just conclude that it's not for them. I guess, is that something that all your non-poker readers have found?
I only have one.
Sorry?
of this book. But I think what it is, though, is actually another beta reader who, Harry, who read it at the same time, Andrew, I asked him specifically, you know, is this readable? He said, non-poker players could read it, because a lot of times I'll tell a poker hand really quick, like he three-barrel bluffed and got called on the river. Okay, a non-poker, and he was pissed. A non-poker player just needs to know he was pissed off, right? And doesn't need to know what three-barrel bluff means. However, there are some hands much more detailed than that. But because this book is specifically about poker pain, the details of the pain itself that are expressed through, you know, by poker players to poker players in this fictional setting, just can't grasp it outside of poker. That's what Harry was saying. That's why he said a non-poker player could read it, but only poker players could really benefit from it. So like in your book that you were talking about where you're in another world, you know, it could be that to get whatever real message or meaning or moral statement or whatever that the writer was trying to get across, still did come across fully without understanding the technical part. But because of this book is about poker pain specifically, it might not be the case.
I see. So the subject of the book is something that is really only accessible to poker players. Like, we've felt it and we understand it, and it's sort of a specific sub kind of pain that you can sort of only know by acquaintance.
Relatableness. Like, for example, in your book, it could be that the pain that the hero experiences is within that area, but it's quite relatable. You can still relate it to your own life. Yeah. Here, we actually have 7 fictional characters in Painless Poker, each one of them designed specifically to be relatable by huge swaths of the poker community. So, you know, you got the guy who's a attorney who all he wants to do is drive to Foxwoods every weekend to play poker. Family. And you know, so many people can relate to that. And then you got an online grinder and a live grinder and a high stakes player. And so the whole idea is that each of these characters relay their specific types of pain, and that poker players who read this will be able to go, oh yeah, I know that one, you know, and that one, and that one. So, but that was freeing for me when I finally, because I was like treading the line, trying to decide it from a marketing standpoint, and also actually from a purpose standpoint, because this book is, it's about a lot of things, but it's ultimately about, we'll just call it spiritual, we'll use that word in a secular way, advancement by way of poker. And I forgot where I was going.
And sort of targeting the book to poker players and not worrying too much about other...
It was freeing to me to not think in terms of trying to market it or write it for non-poker players. And so from a business standpoint, you could say, okay, well, I guess this isn't the book that I'm going to try to sell to the entire world and make a gazillion dollars. But on the other hand, every book about writing and everything I've ever learned about writing says, if you have an audience, write to that audience. Be glad of that and don't fuck with it.
Yeah. You're on this podcast, right? We understand very well just sort of doing your thing and talking to poker players and not making any money. So it's great.
Exactly. And so, that's who it's for. It's for poker players and no one else.
Fantastic. Yeah, I mean, I think I recall in reference to that question of, you know, is this book of interest to other people or readable? I mean, I don't think it's like so full of jargon that people can't understand it, as much as I'm not sure how much, like, you know, there's a zillion books about meditation that exist, mm-hmm. you know, like, and it's sort of like, why would someone read yours as opposed to one of those zillion other ones? And the answer is if they're interested in poker specifically.
Well, actually, that's one answer, but there's actually a much better answer, which is, What I'm really trying to do with this book is fill in what I view as a huge gap in the world of meditation teaching. And that is, how do you pull off a daily meditation practice in the modern world? What is the nuts and bolts? What's the details? So there's a lot more about meditation in here than that. You know, it's about how it works, why it works, and all that stuff.
And there's a lot more to the book besides just meditation.
But one part of the book related to what you just said is specifically about the nuts and bolts of doing it. And the reason I think there's a huge gap there is because when you read books after books about meditation, even ones that say how to do it, I have never seen a book that answers questions like, okay, I've got a job that I need to be at 7:30 and I've got 2 kids. And you're saying I should meditate every day. How? When? What's the deal? And because I have coached quite a few poker players who have become meditators who have dabbled in meditation or who have learned enough about it that they plan to start doing it someday, you know, I've worked with people at every level, but basically at the introductory level. So I have a great deal of experience with talking to clients over periods of years and working with them in the details of their life and coming up with ways together that they can get more meditation in and get more practice in. And so that experience, the coaching experience, is the only thing that has qualified me, I think, to collect material and come up with ideas for different people, different types of people, and different life situations, so that it becomes possible to actually have a daily meditation practice.
Yeah, I was wondering about that because you don't have a 9-to-5 job, you don't have two kids. I guess you're saying it's your experience helping other people with that has given you some insight.
Yeah, and I'll just tell you the short version. And boy, I've waffled on this a lot over the years because I kept wanting it to be easier so that more people could do it, but it's not. If somebody has like a job, you know, in a normal life, and they're not a professional poker player, there's really only one way to do it, and that is to get up an hour earlier than the rest of the household. And it took me 10 years of coaching to get to where I can even say that sentence to you and believe it, that there's no other option. And there you go.
And I've heard that advice for writing as well, for especially for people who have, you know, family or something like that, that the only way they get work done is by, you know, waking up and starting before everyone else is awake.
Yeah. And you know what? The thing I try to do in the book is to gradually bring the reader along. If someone who's interested up to that level, which we're already talking about, you know, maybe 3% of the people or whatever, and show them that it's not a problem to solve this whole idea of getting up early. It doesn't have to be a bad thing at all. Right from the very beginning, even the thought of it doesn't have to be, oh my God, I can't do that. You know. So it's just a lot of attitude, but then that's where it comes down to. So there's so many different types of people. That's why it's been fun to write this book, because as I go through the material with these fictional characters, they keep coming at me with the questions. You know, well, what about this? Well, what about this? What about this? And the whole idea is that I'll, you know, hit on enough of these as we go and write it in a way that's entertaining enough so that somebody would keep going, and eventually they'll come upon something and they're like, oh, that would work for me. You know, I could do that. And so that's kind of the layout of the meditation teaching part of the book.
Well, I will say, Tommy, with all this talk of, you know, whether or not non-poker players would be interested in this book, your other book, Elements of Poker, is the only poker book that my mother, decidedly non-poker player, has ever read. And I think she enjoyed it.
Well, yeah, I'm glad. I've been told the first 50 pages or so are, you know, more readable by non-players.
Yeah, I'm sure there were big chunks she didn't understand, but...
Right. Well, another thing I did about a year or two ago when I just committed to like, okay, this is for poker players, is I've already been thinking about what I'll write next. And I've got 4 or 5 books under development, and somewhere in there I'm going to write something about meditation for non-poker players. I don't think I'm going to write about poker again, maybe ever, in a book. But that's
crushed,
what I realized.
Tommy,
you know what?
I'm crushed.
What's that?
I'm crushed.
Oh, well, maybe this will... I don't know if I have anything else to say after this one, really. But anyway, that was part of the thing. It's like, I can write about meditation all I want outside of poker next. You know, so... Hey, I wanted to bring up something. What's that?
Oh, so you want to bring up something. Can I ask you a quick Elements of Poker question before we do that?
Sure.
Is Carlos Welch the best approximation to the professional from that book you've ever met?
I wish I knew Carlos better. So, go ahead, Andrew. Tell him what about our lunch.
Yes, I mean, I guess I blogged about this briefly, but when Carlos was visiting me in San Francisco, we had the opportunity to head out to Oakland and have lunch with Tommy. And I mean, I had a feeling the two of you would sort of hit it off.
It was amazing. Yeah,
it definitely went better than I thought it would. The number of things that you two had in common in terms of the sort of trajectory of your the ages when you kind of got into poker and the ways you got into it, and I don't even remember all the details now. But
I thought it was
an electrifying afternoon.
We really hit it off. So Nate, so what was your what's behind your question?
No, because one thing that struck with me that struck me the most from Elements of Poker is this idea of the professional, and it's somebody who, if he goes broke at poker, he dies, right? And yeah, right. It's like a regulative ideal. So you ask yourself, what would the professional do? You know, he would be very good at bankroll management. He would game select meticulously. He would have mental control. Like, he would never say like, oh, well, maybe I'll blast off another buy-in or two, because that's a buy-in or two closer to death for him, right? And then you look at Carlos, and this is a man who really, really does not want to get a job that is not poker, right? And of course, he does poker writing and other things that aren't poker, but he is so committed to his way of life, and that's really important to him.
Yeah.
And so whenever he makes any decision, I mean, he lives in a van. He studies poker voraciously. He's such a committed poker student. He watches every penny. He game selects as meticulously as I've seen basically anybody else ever do that. And he's just really committed to poker. And I think part of the point, I think, of this professional character or regulative ideal is that it sort of expands to fill your whole life, and you can examine any decision from the point of view of dying or not dying as a professional. And I think Carlos is like the best representation of that I've ever seen. So that's my argument. Agree or disagree?
Right. Well, and that is the purpose of the idea, is to keep you, you know, aiming, just pretend as if you were Carlos. No, you're right. You told me some things there that I knew. I've read some of his stuff and this and that, but hearing it from you, I kind of reminded me of how meticulous he is on those things. And yeah, he really is living a professional life but not as a trick or a tool. That's just really how he processes his decisions at the base level.
That's who he is.
That's who he is. That's great.
Okay. So thank you for talking to me about that. But you had something you wanted to talk about, so let's talk about that instead.
I just thought, Andrew and I had the briefest email exchange in preparation for this interview, which basically said we're not going to prepare anything and we're not going to tell you anything from the microphone. But you mentioned William
Kassouf.
How do you say it?
Kassouf, I believe.
Kassouf. So I went and looked him up and watched one of the hands. So is this something that all listeners know about?
Yeah, so we interviewed him maybe two or three episodes ago, and he's also been he was, as I understand, I haven't actually watched too much of the WSOP coverage myself, but my understanding is that the coverage of the last few days of the WSOP main event really focused a lot on him. I mean, A, because he was kind of putting on a show in a way that others weren't, and B, because he was involved in some controversies that, you know, made for good televising. So I think he's kind of been the talk of the poker world for the last few weeks.
Okay, well, hell, I got a couple words to say then.
Please.
No, the reason I like this topic, because it's about live poker, which is, you know, I just love everything there is to do with live poker. So the hand I watched was the one where he had king-king against the other guy's ace-ace. Mm-hmm. Do you know the hand I'm talking about?
I know that it happened. I'm not real familiar with the details of it.
Okay. Oh, okay. Well, that's the only one I saw. So his opponent, I wish I knew his name.
It was Griffin Benger, right?
Yeah.
What was it? Benger?
Yeah, I believe so. Griffin Benger?
Oh, that sounds right. Benger. Yeah.
And he's at the final table now.
Okay. Now, let me say something. Preface this with, I am... I couldn't tell you one name of a single player at the final table in the last 4 years unless it was a client, and I've had two. So I just don't follow poker. I'm like very stingy with what I do with my word input, because I'm writing and messing with words all day. And so I've just kind of like filtered certain things out of my life, and that's one of them. So I don't know. I'm not up on the modern world of players or their history or anything like that at all. Okay. So I just wanted to comment on his hand and say that the hero was Benger to me. I mean, I was like watching this hand, I'm like, this is who they should be talking about. I was just so impressed and so blown away with his ability to not move, because that's what you know, that's what my whole thing is with my clients and how to win the information war is to send less information and gather more information. You send less information by not moving and being still. And guess what? That also allows you to gather more information. So that's, you know, anytime I see a player doing what he did, I'm like, okay, that's the pinnacle to me. And you can only show off that skill when you have another guy babbling on for a while. You know what I mean? So the stage was set for us to see what I would call just a perfect display of waiting the other guy out. Now, but as far as Kasuf, to me, I listened to his whole rant. That I don't mean that in a negative way. I listened to his words, and to me, it struck me as absolutely ordinary. There was nothing unusual about anything I saw, anything he said, any way he acted, because I've played with players who behave like that hundreds of times all over the country for, you know, 30 years. And when I'm playing a player like that, it's just like anyone else does. You know, if you were playing against me in 5 minutes, you'd have me in a box. You will categorize me as a certain type of player, either consciously or unconsciously, right? We all do that. And when I'm playing against a guy like that, it's like, okay, I've played against this guy many, many times. There's nothing unusual about it. And I know how to play. I know, to me, the key thing about playing against a guy like that is not having it upset you. That's it. There's no other part to the game. The words mean nothing. The antics mean nothing. My whole thing is like, okay, can I sit here and love this guy and wish him well and not think anything bad about him, no matter what he says? Because if I can do that, then I know I can maintain my peace and tranquility perfectly, no matter what he does or says. You know, it'd be interesting to get inside the Wenger's mind and hear what was his actual emotional state while that was going on. Was he, you know, as calm as he looked? Because that was very impressive. So anyway, my view is that sometimes people have the camera on them and they're doing what seems like an unusual behavior. It's actually perfectly normal, but it's exciting for the cameras. And so here's a guy who to me was just a typical chatterbox. He just happened to be at the final table of the World Series or whatever.
But part of the reason I was curious to ask you specifically is that I remember, I think it was in Elements of Poker, you say that what Kasuf calls speech play, or the idea of, you know, talking and using that in order to either tilt your opponents or provoke your opponents or manipulate them in some way. You claim that you were capable, you were really good at that. And you made a decision to stop doing it. And it didn't seem like that was purely a tactical decision, like that you felt like you were giving away more information than you were gaining through needling people or whatever. I guess it kind of presented as sort of an ethical decision, or I was just wondering if maybe you can say a little bit more about whether I'm right that that was something that you believed you were very good at, and if why you made a conscious decision to stop doing that.
Well, I'm glad you brought this up. So a little bit of clarification. The thing that I was very, very good at was needling, period. Now, I don't mean during the hands. I just mean in general. Okay. The thing that I was not good at was what did you call it?
Speech play is the term he uses.
Speech play was never a strong part of my game.
Okay.
Where, now you got to keep in mind that we didn't play no limit back then. This is a different world. When you're playing limit hold'em, there's no time for speech play. There is speech play, but not like you see today, right? That situation that we see all the time with these long waits, those literally never, ever happened during the first 12 years of my poker playing career. So that's a different world. But even when it did happen, we did play some pot limit and okay, so let's say 2000, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and now up to now, I've been playing no limit this whole time. A lot. Speech play has never been a strong part of my game. I've never felt good with that. But I was very good at needling and making people upset. And that was when I stopped, because it was an asshole behavior. a conscious decision about it costing me money or anything like that. Now, one more comment about speech play. You know, as I listened to that guy Krusoff and players I've been with, I mean, you would have a hard time convincing me that all of his words are consciously scripted in his mind before they come out with a specific idea that he's going to get a read off a guy who hasn't moved in 2 minutes. You see what I mean? I mean, at some point, it's unrealistic to think, okay, here's a guy who's a master at speech play, consciously crafting words so that he can get a read out of a guy who isn't blinking or moving.
Yeah, that was also not the sense we got interviewing him, I think.
Yeah, so it's just, to me, and I don't mean this in a negative way, I'm just in an analytical way, it's mindless chatter. And he just happens to have a camera on him.
Yeah. Yeah, and I do think he's, I mean, I agree that probably not everything he says is real carefully calculated beforehand. I imagine where his skill lies is probably more when the opponent does react, figuring out what that means, and having a game that's sort of well suited to opponents who are angry and pained and on tilt a lot.
Yeah. Well, in all fairness, okay, a master at speech play isn't crafting it and thinking about it. It's improvised, and he's getting reads consciously and unconsciously that then go into his experience and produce a better betting strategy than he would have had without that.
Yeah.
Right. So I know, I'm totally down on there can be people who, even though it's mindless chatter, it definitely makes them money because they're just so good at it. They know how to play it.
Yeah. But I think there are also people who talk a lot where it's not mindless at all, where really mm-hmm. every word that they say is if not consciously deliberated, there's a point, there's a justification to mm-hmm. it, and there's a pretty clever plan behind it that's sort of narrowly tailored to each individual opponent. Like, I think I've played with people like that, too. I don't know if you'd agree with that.
No, I would agree with that. Even though I don't, in the games I play in, don't see that much of that, so I don't have a whole lot of experience that in recent times. But I would agree with you. There's going to be people that are very good at it because they've worked at it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, actually, are you familiar with the book Verbal Poker Tells?
Yeah, we've interviewed the author.
Oh yeah. Okay. Well, I'm in fact, I might have written a blurb for that. I'm really impressed with how he put that together. Are you?
Yeah, I think it's a great book. I mean, having read other books on Tells, I think he's like, you know, heads and shoulders above.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the other prominent Tell books out there.
Right. Oh, Zachary.
Yeah.
Elwood. There we go. So the reason I mention it is because, and I have this, and I've worked this into Painless Poker. This little point of pride, we'll say, is that by playing mum poker, which I do, I just don't talk at all. All of that awesome information in that huge book is completely useless against me. I just want to get that.
I was curious, partly. So the controversy surrounding Kasuf is in part about, you know, the things he's saying and whether he's ever crossing the line in terms of just kind of consistently going after people and possibly like not giving them ample opportunity to think when they're in the tank, if he's just kind of constantly talking and they can't concentrate on their decision. So part of it's been about that, and part of it has just been about the pace of the game, which already, I mean, deep in the main event tends to be kind of painfully slow. Everyone's taking a long time on almost every decision. And then on top of that, you know, there's instances where he's, you know, tanking and talking and stuff when it's 100% clear that he's going to fold. You know, he's just like, you know, under the gun with a bad hand or or whatever. It's just like he's definitely
going to fold. Yeah.
And so, you know, I'm not surprised to hear you say that when it comes to the speech intended to tilt you or to cause pain, that your answer to that is just sort of like, well, you know, it's just words and you just sort of have to accept it and not get tilted by it, basically. Right. And it doesn't have to affect you unless you let it. But it doesn't seem like that same argument applies to someone who's, you know, stalling, because that's costing you money, whether it upsets you or not. It is something, I mean, by slowing down the pace of playing, getting in fewer hands, you know, that's potentially bad. I mean, for a winning player anyway, that's something that costs you money.
But it's not bad unless it upsets you, really. I mean, if the guy's not breaking the rules, and you're playing poker, and you're getting upset over anything, you're kind of fucked. I mean, really? How many, you know, it's totally random. If a guy comes to your table and let's say you got a guy who comes to the table and his strategy is to wait as long as he can wait every single time.
Yeah.
And only to piss people off and tilt them. Okay.
Which is against the rules, by the way.
Pardon me?
Which is against the rules, right?
Well, I mean, well, to whatever extent he can do whatever he can do within the rules, whatever.
Okay, you know, okay,
my,
sure.
My point is that here you have a random event in your life that's upsetting you. You know, it could be that you got a text that your cat just died. You know, it's all random shit coming at you, whether it's at the table or from somewhere else. And so being able to consciously feel the heat and consciously dispel the heat, there's nothing more important than that. That's it. So when a guy comes down to the table and he's super irritated, that's good. Irritating. Let's say I'm playing 5-10 at you know, the World Series, playing 5-10 no limit in the cash game room, and we got a normal slow pace game going, and some guy sits down and for whatever reason, he's a total asshole, and half hour later, he's got half the table upset. He's like dumping money in my pocket if I don't get upset. All I have to do is not get upset, and he's making me money. So the bigger the hassle is, the better for the people who don't get upset, whether it's a tournament or whatever. I don't mean asshole. I mean whatever behavior tends to piss people off, you know, that's got to be good.
Do you ever call the floor? I mean, I know you don't play poker much, but do you ever find yourself calling for enforcement of rules?
Well, there was two questions. One was, do I ever call the floor? I just called the floor last time I was in Vegas for something, but it wasn't a rule enforcement. It was a case where it was something that had happened where I had actually acted slightly out of turn. Anyway, it doesn't matter. It wasn't a rule. The answer is no.
All right. Would you call the clock on somebody if they had been tanking for a long time? No,
absolutely not. And I coach all my guys to never call the clock on anybody.
Even if they're kind of doing it every hand and you believe doing it sort of for the purpose of stalling, still no calling the clock.
Right. Because it's a battle of wits. And as soon as you call the clock, you've lost. Because people only call the clock when they're not at peace. Okay. So if you got a guy whose goal is to piss people off and he gets you to call the clock on him, he's won. That's how I see it. He's won the battle.
So I will never call the clock. I think it's a bad play at live poker, no matter what.
If a player is really in a place where he can field whatever comes at him without being upset, then if someone's really in that place, it really doesn't matter if the player acts in 5 seconds or an hour. You know, it doesn't matter if the game just breaks up at that moment. In that place, it isn't a matter of having the urge to call the clock and then saying no to it. It's like it doesn't even come up. Okay. So now that's like the ultimate, which is a hard place to get to and stay at. In the meantime, I think the way to handle the long stalls in live poker is the guy's taking forever, you get upset. And then you, okay, breathing in, I'm aware of upset again. This has happened 8 million times because I'm a poker player. And now I'm just going to dispel it again. Okay, guys, this guy ever going to fucking bet? It's been another 30 seconds. I hope somebody else calls the clock. Because I'm not going to let him see me suffer. I'm not going to let him know I'm upset. But I wish somebody else would call the clock. Oh, wait, I'm upset again. That's the cycle.
I guess I'm struggling a little bit with the idea that you have to be upset to call the clock. I mean, I certainly don't think you have to be emotionally upset. I guess you're saying you're still just sort of perturbed in some way or making a judgment about the state of the universe.
No, exactly. Upset is too strong of a word. Here's the best word. Dissatisfied. You're dissatisfied with the situation as it is at that exact second.
And that's already making a judgment.
Because you wish the guy would act, right? You're dissatisfied over the fact that he has not acted yet. I'm calling that upset or tilt.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, I still foresee calling the clock.
Well, no, you know, I mean, I guess your reason, if you're playing live cash poker for a living, see, at the tournament, I don't see how it's a disadvantage if everybody has to wait the same amount of time. At live poker, you could say, okay, this guy's costing me 3 hands per hour. It's not going to cost me that much if he knows I'm pissed at him. You know, maybe he's a really tight player, you're never going to play any pots. So at that point, it could be a conscious decision. I need to speed up the game, get more hands in, because I'm a professional poker player. That's a non-emotional decision.
Yeah, I would say the same thing
applies to tournaments, right?
Well, I don't know tournaments enough. It seems to me like everybody suffers the same or gains the same, right?
But if you have an edge, then so every minute that goes by, the sort of Dan Harrington Langoliers come for you, right? And the fewer hands you get, the closer you get to some threshold where the stacks get really short, or
I see,
or whatever. Yeah, so you
right. If you could play 1,000 hands an hour, for example, that would be the best for you.
Yeah, that's right.
More better. Yeah.
Other things equal.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And it can be especially true at tournaments. Like, a lot of times your edge can be very, very sensitive to the stack sizes involved, and sometimes you maybe do want to, you know, the take a warp zone to a shorter stack size, but very often you'd rather get more hands in.
Right. Okay. Well, so in that case, there would definitely be at times where if you know that you're just simply okay, I'm going to retract everything. if you call the clock because you're dissatisfied, that's not good. If you call the clock because it's the right play to make you the most money and you're not upset about anything, that's fine.
All right. Okay. I think for me it's like 80 to 90% the latter. I don't generally get upset about okay. it as much as I'm just like, okay, this is costing me money.
Right. Okay. So, but my point still stands. If you're making it if you're making it because you're upset, that's not good. And I think you would agree with that. But yeah, but there's bound to be plenty of times where perfectly rationally calm poker players call the clock with no emotional baggage attached to it at all.
Yeah. So speaking of calling the clock, you said you never do it during a hand. I think something like the following situation comes up sometimes where you're bluffing someone and he's got the hand you think he has, and he's not sort of mentally prepared to call off a lot of money with that hand. Like, he just doesn't, at the current time, he just doesn't have the sort of emotional stuff to put his money in the pot with that hand. But if he thinks a while, he might sort of muster up the courage.
Right.
So calling the clock, after he's had a reasonable amount of time, maybe 2-3 minutes, calling the clock can be sort of a way to keep him from sort of summoning the requisite guts to put the money in the pot. As such, even if you show a little bit of, you know, weakness or dissatisfaction or whatever by calling the clock, I mean, not dissatisfaction, but
right.
Yeah, it can still be the money-making move. Approve or disapprove?
So you're saying that you think that if you call the clock, he's going to do what you want him to do, but if you don't call the clock, he's going to do the other thing.
That's right.
That's a hell of a read to have, though.
I think it comes up pretty often. I think I play smaller than okay. you do, and I think, like, at 2-5, there are a lot of people who... you know, it's 2016. They think a lot about poker, and you know, they sort of understand. You know, they maybe over time they could figure out that I'm bluffing, but they have a very strong inclination to, you know, not put $300 in the pot with second pair.
And you think calling the clock is going to make them more likely to fold?
Yeah, just because. Okay. Yeah, I think it makes them more likely to do the default. I mean, of course, the fact that I call the clock gives them information, and of well, course they can factor. Sorry.
But
it's opponent dependent, but I think sometimes you know, they just sort of don't have it in them at the, you know, for the time being. And I know it doesn't happen every day or even every week, but you know, more than once a year, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Maybe we'll get to play sometime.
Yeah.
Do you go to the World Series
every year?
Well, this I didn't go last year. This year I'm going for 2 weeks. So I'm gonna make a note here. See you, Nate.
Yeah, that'd be fun. That'd be, wait, I'm making a note too. See see.
I'll be there for the 2 weeks probably before the main event starts.
Yeah, that's usually when I'm around. So
okay.
Yeah. Excellent.
Well, we'll play 2-5.
Yeah. It'll be fun. Or, I mean, yeah, 5-10 is fine also. So.
Or 5-10, whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it'll be fun.
I thought you were a PLO player these days, Tommy.
Oh, I forgot. Actually, I've played 2 weeks of PLO now at ARIA. 2 5-day stints.
How'd you like it? I guess if you don't mind slow games, then PLO is pretty good for you. And if you don't tilt as much as your opponents,
yeah, I really like it.
Yeah,
I actually got I had lunch with Phil Galfond and got some coaching from him. Actually, what I did was I just wanted to run by him my plan, and he approved, which is. I'm basically shooting for the lowest VPIP and live PLO in the history of the galaxy. That's my objective. And it's working great for me. It really is.
Yeah. I mean, if you're at an eight-handed table, if you just muck your hand without looking at it in one of the first three spots, how much are you losing?
Oh, you do that too? yeah, exactly. See, here's the thing with PLO. This is I've got some really sick experience with this game. All right. So in 1990, when I started playing for a living in these circuit of basement games in Columbus, Ohio, it wasn't until like 91 that we started playing Hold'em with casino style with two blinds and a button and all that. The way we played there was called better get, meaning each round of betting, the first to act moved around one seat to the left during a hand. And when the action was on you first, you either had to fold or bet. There was no checking. Okay, this is how we played for years. And so what that means is we'd be playing 3-6. So on the flop, you know, if you're first to act, you just have to bet $3 or fold, period. And it's super loose players, so we had these massive pots. So check out this game we played. Omaha, high only, limit.
Huh.
Better get, 3-6. So limit Omaha. Have you ever even conceived of this game in your mind, what that would be like?
Try to make the nuts, I think. That's.
Well, I mean, but with loose players, it's just a free-for-all of chips, right? It's just ridiculous. So I played this game, well, maybe thousands, hundreds of hours for years, because the game continued. Even when we started, some places played regular Hold'em. There was always places that had this game. And we also played a lot of high-low Omaha and variants of Omaha. So I've been dealt many, many four-card hands with five-card boards back then, but not in the modern world of PLO. So I have a lot of experience deep in my bones about what a dangler is and what it means. Difference between having a dangler and not having a dangler. And it's like, so this is really easy for me. It's a very clear line in my mind of like, okay, this is a good hand, and then there's all these other hands. And so the way I look at it is, when it comes to playing super nitty tight preflop or playing a more normal creative game, to me, the profitability of the super nitty style depends only on one factor, which is how many chips are in motion per minute or per hour. It's just simply a function of chips in motion. If there's enough chips moving around in the pots, then the super nitty style can make plenty of money, even if, you know, quote unquote, they know how tight you are. You know? So that's what I looked at when I was playing the 5-10. It's 2-5 with a rock at ARIA. You guys both know that structure, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's a good size game. No cap.
What's the rock? How big?
10.
Okay.
It's 2-5-10, and well, it's Omaha. I mean, people are putting money in the pot, and I was like, you know, I think I can just knit this game up and still have a really good EV. And here's the beautiful part in terms of painlessness, and not put myself in
tricky big pot situations against guys who have been playing Omaha for 5 years and I just showed up yesterday. You know, that was the beautiful part about the strategy, is that I know I'm walking into a modern world of Omaha that's been studied and known, and there's so much known that I have I know nothing about any of that. I know how to play poker, I know how to play pot limit, I know how everything about stack sizes and position, but I didn't know the details. And a lot of the details that I don't know have to deal with hands in that middle range. And so I just didn't play those hands.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, it makes perfect sense. And in fact, this game sounds like one of the ideal devices for transferring money to Tommy Angelo, like with the Rock and the Omaha and the live poker. I mean, do they also have time pots? I bet there are time pots just to transfer more money to you.
They didn't have time pots as assholes, but they did have a very low, you know, a nice low Vegas half hour rake or whatever. I mean, it was, but you're right. You're right. I really felt like, so it's like, if I want to play that style, I play Omaha, where it's almost a brain dead style. It obviously it gets interesting, and I do pick up pots now and then. There are certain times where they just have to fold because of how I'm playing. Yeah. And but if I want to like play real poker, then I go play 5-10 no limit. You know, so right now PLO, I'm playing a very kind of a non-creative style, but it's really fun for me because I love watching the game. That's the other thing. It's a really fun game to watch.
Yeah, front row seat.
Yeah, exactly.
Does that still kind of scratch? Like, do you still feel like you have the same itch that needs to be scratched that you did when you first started playing poker? Because just from having read the memoir sections of Painless Poker, where you talk about what you were like as a early poker player, it seems that you were just kind of always jonesing to get into a game, and obviously that's kind of the opposite of where you are now. But I mean, when you do want to play, is it kind of the same sensation?
No, I can't ever get that hooked on it like that. Because partly it's just natural aging and playing so much, but I've changed quite a bit by way of meditation and all that. So the amount of jonesing I have experienced and my reaction to it has been a gradual, very gradual change over the years. It was kind of funny when I was still living in Palo Alto, let's say, 6-7 years ago, I was still playing locally now and then, and there were times I'd be like, oh, I'm gonna go play poker, and then on my way to put my key in the car, I'd be like, I'm just gonna stay home. I mean, so I would get Joneses and then they would just go away before I even got there. And now I don't play locally at all. I just go to Vegas a few times a year and play for 4 or 5 days, and it's been the same jonesing cycle on a longer scale. It's like a couple months will go by, I'll get no Jones, and then I'll be like, maybe I'll go to Vegas and I'll schedule a trip and it'll be a couple months away. So the answer to the question is I have almost no poker Jones in that old way anymore. I just don't have that type of craving for anything, really. And also the part of my love of playing poker now, it isn't the act of playing poker. It's the immersion in the scene in Vegas, just getting away, from my normal life and breaking it up. That's part of the experience that I like now.
Yeah, the poker world has changed a lot. It's nice to hear that you can still get that satisfaction from the modern poker world.
I do. I really do. I love playing when I'm down there and playing. I love it, but it isn't the sort of feed the degeneracy type of thing. I just like being there playing, it's just fun.
Yeah, but it's never your very old articles about with the olives and playing guitar with Devilfish and all that, may he rest in peace. that world is gone forever, right?
Oh yeah. Yeah, it's been, well, yeah. I would say right soon after I started meditating around 2003, right around then, my World Series trips 04, 05, that's when I started being actually disciplined. By discipline, I mean living on a 24-hour cycle, waking up, doing meditation, yoga, having a normal breakfast, going back to my room, doing emails, have a little nap. I would do all of that before I would play.
And then when I would play, I would only play, you know, never more than 90 minutes, basically doing all this stuff I coached guys. That's why my game got to where it is now, is from the coaching. And, you know, I mean, I don't know if Nate, have you done, I know Ender's done coaching, right?
Yeah, I do coaching too.
Yeah, I mean, it makes a big difference to, don't you think it's keeps you in line kind of thing? And then, and you know, you're forced to, if you have a really good idea that you've sort of forgotten about and you tell somebody else about it, it's almost like you're telling yourself that again.
Yeah, and absolutely.
I think that process is really what made my game come together, but my disciplines toward playing poker and like aiming for my A game all the time. I never used to think in those terms.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I do a lot of asynchronous coaching where students send me stuff and I think about it and write about it and write back to them. That works, mm-hmm. you know, that tends to work a little bit better. And these days, that's a lot of my total studying. So that's, yeah, in a lot of ways, I think coaching is, it forces me to raise my game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a big breakout for me is if I order like two with giant pieces of pizza at that place right next to the Aria Poker Room and go eat those in my room while I pass out to a stupid movie. That's as decadent as I get now.
$5.50. That place is great. That's my favorite place to eat in the Aria.
You know what? I learned something very interesting about that place my last trip, because I went over there. I went up to the comp table, you know, the comp kiosk, and I said, give me an $11 comp, which is for two pieces of pizza. And he said, are you going to the pizza place? And I said, yeah. He goes, well, they're $6 a slice now.
What? I'm like, did they change the name?
How can you have – now, let me ask you this, Nate. When you first heard the name of that place,
yeah.
Okay, just so people know what we're talking about. It's a pizza place next to Aria Poker Room called 550. That's the name of it. And they sell pizza by the slice for $5.50 per slice. Now, when you heard about that itself, did you think to yourself, well, what kind of ridiculous branding is that? They're going to need to raise the price someday.
I did not think about that. No, I didn't.
You didn't think? I did.
Yeah. Well, you have better forethought than I do. I think that's a great example of what economists call the menu cost of inflation. But
but the mystery is about to be solved for you.
Okay.
And anyone listening, which is, so the guy says it's $6 a slice now. I'm like, okay. How's that work with a place called 550? And I said something like that. And he goes, because he's heard this before. He goes, well, actually, the 550 refers to the temperature of the oven.
Nice.
It was just a coincidence that they charged $5.50 a slice.
Wow. Yeah, that's good. That's good. I like that. I mean, I was always a little bit surprised because, like, those slices are big. It's really like getting or three or even four slices, and getting that much pizza for $5.50 may not sound like much of a deal, but by Aria standards, it's the steal of the century.
They got my business.
Oh yeah, I mean every time, and it's right next to the sports book. So I mean, if you're a big sports fan like me, just grab some pizza, get a free drink in the sports book. You know, watch whatever you want. It's fantastic.
This is exactly when I Jones. is when I'm talking to a client or talking to you guys. Like right now, if you just beam me to Vegas, I'd be happy as hell.
Oh man, yeah, we could play some Omaha together, eat a bunch of pizza, watch some baseball. It's yeah,
oh, football, man. Whatever.
Yeah, it sounds pretty good. And that man. anything else? So you got a book coming out. You have a new website, www.tommyangelo.com. What else should our listeners know about what you got going on?
Here's what my mailing list is. You can go to my website and down on the footer, there's a sign up form for the mailing list. Please join. I send just a very simple email about three times a year, but
they're always entertaining too. They're not just like boring promotional emails.
And excuse me, thank you. I try to be, you know, not too intrusive, but I am planning to release Painless Poker March 1st. You know, things could possibly change, but I'll probably be sending out some kind of discount promo or other fun behind the scenes stories. I've collected all kinds of bits and pieces as I've been making this book that I might put out. So anyway, join the mailing list, TommyAngelo.com, and you'll be up to date on everything. I intend to start. I haven't really been blogging much for the last few years, but I've been saving up blogs. I've got about 30 blogs written and a whole bunch of tweets, and so I'm just going to be spraying content through the internet, starting probably around February.
Well, I for one look forward to drinking from the Tommy Angelo social media fire hose.
Well, there's never been one, so we'll have to see what that looks like.
and we're happy to contribute to it as well. I mean, I imagine you'll want to do some podcast interviews around the time the book comes out. So don't consider this your last opportunity to
plug. No, you'll be hearing from me on that. And so actually, that's, you know, some people I'm hoping to have the book in the can completely done 1 month before release so that I can send it to reviewers and bloggers or whatever who want to do like a pre-release review. So I was going to be writing to you guys about that eventually anyway, but we might want to, you know, we could do that if you want.
I'd love that. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm making a note. Okay.
Well, it's great to talk to you. Thanks so much for coming on the show, and I hope we can work out our schedules and play a little poker together next summer.
Oh, I'm sure we will. I've got you down. I'll track you down.
Fantastic. And good luck with everything, and best wishes, and I'm looking forward to the book.
Okay, thanks. You too.
Take care.
See ya.